It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about a recent surprise discovery at UW-Madison, specimens that were collected by George Washington Carver.
First, some sobering news from USA Today Network Wisconsin. The number of babies born in the state addicted to opiates is on the rise. According to their analysis of data from different state departments, the number of babies born addicted to opiates has more than doubled since 2009. In Wisconsin.
Our next guest joins us now for a look at how local governments are reacting. Anne LaChapelle is the Access and Initial Assessment Supervisor for the Wood County Human Services Department. Anne, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So typically speaking, for someone in a human services department, when do you find out about a child who's born addicted to opiates?
Generally, what I've been seeing more of in recent years is we're typically getting those reports for unborn babies. So typically the information is coming into us prior to the baby's delivery and birth.
So what's in your toolkit, I guess? What kind of reaction are you able to provide in that situation?
We do those types, if the information is coming from a credible, reliable source, obviously some sort of professional or medical provider, or if we have a history with that individual, what will likely happen is a social worker will be assigned to go out and complete an assessment on the concerns. Typically, we'd be asking the expectant mother to submit to some urinalysis tests so we can confirm or deny if she is, in fact, abusing drugs or alcohol. And then we kind of go from there, depending on how receptive she is or wanting to engage in services with our department.
So assuming that she does cooperate in that situation, what kind of services would be available?
Typically, we would work, the unit that I supervise, Child Protective Services, we're housed in our Family Services Division, but we work quite closely with our behavioral health staff, which would include our drug and alcohol counselors, and would work with those staff to get an assessment intake scheduled so they could kind of identify what service delivery system would be most appropriate. In some cases, it might be outpatient counseling. In other cases, more serious cases, we might be looking at trying to facilitate some residential inpatient treatment for that expectant mother.
And if the expectant mother didn't cooperate, I understand under state law there are some, in effect, coercive measures that that can be taken.
There was legislation enacted a number of years ago. It's been on the books for probably at least 20 years now. We operate primarily under Wisconsin State Statute 48, the Children's Code. And in there is legislation that does provide for us to seek and establish jurisdiction over unborn babies in cases where we have confirmation or proof that a mother has been exhibiting to a severe degree a dependency on alcohol or other controlled substances, and that use of that drug is, in fact, putting her unborn baby at serious risk.
As I understand... Well, as I understand it, this has come up just 11 times in Wood County over the last handful of years. But as we mentioned, around the state, we're seeing numbers go up. So maybe there's not a norm, but does the expectant mother usually cooperate and work with the services that you provide?
It really varies. I mean, I think in the past, probably more of the cases that we dealt with involved maybe an alcohol dependency or cocaine. In more recent years, I think we're seeing more of the methamphetamine heroin addiction, which, you know, from what I can see so far, is a much more difficult addiction to overcome. And so probably in the past year, a handful of cases I can think of, we haven't had as much success engaging the mothers in services, or they've made attempts and maybe have relapsed quite quickly. So it really is kind of varies across the board. What we do in those situations, we can actually request our district attorney's office to file legal jurisdiction prior to the baby's birth with hopes of getting the mother engaged in some services, because the goal is to really keep her as clean and sober as possible for the duration of that pregnancy, so that that unborn baby has the best possible outcome, you know, upon delivery.
Talking to Anne LaChapelle from the Wood County Human Services Department, looking at a news statewide from the USA Today team here in Wisconsin, finding a rise around the state in the number of babies born already addicted to heroin and other opiates. So let's talk, Anne, about once the baby is born, they are addicted to opiates. What happens then?
Well, typically what happens upon delivery, depending on where that expectant mother is at in her recovery process, If she's not, you know, willing or interested or open to services at that time, what's likely going to happen is we would take custody of that baby upon birth from the hospital, physical custody. Oftentimes those babies aren't ready to be discharged within 2 to 3 days, like a standard delivery. And so they would remain hospitalized, often in the neonatal intensive care unit, for up to 3, maybe 4 weeks as they kind of go through that withdrawal process so they can be medically monitored. If at that point we don't feel it's safe for the baby to return to the mother's care, if she's still actively using, obviously those babies tend to be a lot more colicky or difficult to soothe, and so it's kind of not an ideal combination to put a very, you know, high needs baby, newborn baby with a drug addicted parent. So typically what we do is we look first to see if there's relatives that would be available to take temporary placement of that child. Oftentimes we have success in locating relatives for that purpose. If not, then the next best option would be looking at one of our county licensed foster homes to accept placement of the baby.
Right. It sounds like you're trying to avoid a dual problem of the physical problem of the baby addicted to an opiate, and then the parent trying to deal with their own addiction at the same time.
Right, right. And so that would be just be setting up that parent for failure, either for potential further neglect of that newborn baby, or even in some cases, you know, physical abuse. So, but we try to, in some cases, we have had success where the expectant mom has been open to services. We have a variety of options that we can look at depending on where resources are at as far as availability. But we've had, in the past, we've had situations where we've helped facilitate admission into an inpatient facility. And then once they go through that inpatient treatment program, maybe stepping down into some sort of a halfway house program or community-based residential facility, a clean and sober living environment until they can kind of get stabilized. But again, I think in the past year or two, we've seen that become a lot more challenging just with the level of addiction that we have seen. And, you know, recovery does not come as easily as we may have experienced in past cases.
Well, and given that, it seems like the best case would be to avoid this conversation, avoid this problem altogether. Are there efforts in Wood County to reach out, keep people from getting addicted to heroin, expectant mothers in particular?
I think on a broader sense, I know that our Wood County Health Department has had some great initiatives in the last 3 to 5 years. They have, longer than that, they've had a Healthy People Coalition, and right now they have some subcommittees looking at specific topics, one of them being drug and alcohol dependence, not just for expectant mothers, but just the community at large, and looking at it kind of from a two-pronged approach, from effective treatment options, as well as what preventative measures can we take to kind of avoid people becoming addicted. So I think there's different things happening at different levels within the community, but certainly we recognize it is becoming, you know, more of an issue, not just here in central Wisconsin, but I think across the state.
And thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Anne LaChapelle, Access and Initial Assessment Supervisor for the Wood County Human Services Department. Increase Lapham came to Wisconsin to build a canal, but he became the state's first scientist. Lapham's curiosity led him to investigate everything from trees to Indian mounds to the weather. Biographers Paul Hayes and Martha Berglund tell us about the life of this Wisconsin legend.
Increase Allen Lapham was 25 when he got to Milwaukee, and within days he was walking the woods and walking the beach, taking measurements, taking temperature of the river, doing everything that his curiosity led him into.
He had been doing these same observations, gathering the same data since he was a young teenager. His first article about his observations was written when he was 16. The editor wasn't aware at the time that he was publishing a 16-year-old boy. He had almost no formal education, and that was a great sorrow of his. But as soon as he was able to work, he had to work because the family was a large one and they needed money, and he was able to earn money young as 13 on the Erie Canal.
It was canal work that brought him here, and for the first time in his life, he had arrived at the actual frontier of settlement. He's a curious man who's interested in every aspect of nature, and Wisconsin is an unexplored, undescribed blank tablet. And if anybody in the East, any botanist, any geologist wants to know about the plants and the rocks here, they have to write to Lapham. And he develops a wide-ranging correspondence with the then greatest scientists in the country, not only in the United States, but also in Europe.
So he knew he was their eyes and ears on the frontier, and they were very excited that they were going to have this good observer. And he was very generous with his time and energy and sent many specimens, many letters, many descriptions to the east, to the south. He was sort of the point man for science in Wisconsin territory.
So the question comes up, why was he forgotten? He left behind so much material that it's hard to get your hands around it. The science he was working in at the time was cutting-edge science, brand new ideas that he was bringing to the frontier. He would do lectures that were just astonishingly modern for the time. But since then, in the century and a half since he died, the science he worked in has become settled science. It's the science you learn when you're in the primary grades.
So the star scientists became more and more the specialists. And Increase was a generalist on the frontier, and his kind of science was being replaced. One of the main reasons to me that Lapham is important is that he was, in some ways, a model citizen. He was honest, he was amazingly thorough in whatever he set out to do, and he said that in order to build a good society, we had to build it on a knowledge of where we had come from.
Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes are the authors of Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Increase Lapham also had a role in the founding of the Wisconsin State Herbarium, and last month, staff at the herbarium discovered century-old fungal specimens that had been collected by the famous scientist and educator George Washington Carver.
And we're joined now by Ken Cameron, who is a professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, what can you tell us about this historic discovery?
Yeah, it was really a surprise to us. We have a very large collection of fungi, approximately 120,000 specimens. And when most people think of fungi, they're thinking of mushrooms. But these are not mushrooms. They're microfungi, or we sometimes call them parasitic fungi. They are the rusts and smuts and other nasty things like mildews that affect crop plants in particular. So we were funded by the National Science Foundation to digitize, in other words, to database our entire collection of these very important fungi. And we had no idea that George Washington Carver was even interested in them. Most people think of George Washington Carver and his famous work with peanuts. Mm-hmm. But in the process of databasing our collection, we came upon 25 specimens that were collected by the man himself.
And these, just to stick with the microfungi a bit, these are a big deal in agriculture. You mentioned something, it was something like this that caused the great potato famine in Ireland, right? That was in this category?
Yes, exactly. And so many other crop plants. I mean, any of the farmers who are listening or people who have a home vegetable garden will recognize things like powdery mildew and blights. In the old days, white pine blister rust was a very important, devastating disease of the white pine timber industry. So these are potentially catastrophic fungi that cause diseases. Not all of them. Some of them are you know, benign. But in the early days of the university's founding, with our agricultural history, documenting these pathogenic or disease-causing fungi was very important to the early scientists.
And how did these specimens end up in Wisconsin?
So, to my understanding, I'm not a scholar of George Washington Carver, but I can tell you that he was the first African American student at what became Iowa State University, and his mentor studied fungi and these microfungi in particular. So he obviously received his training, He was then recruited to the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, where he continued his scientific study and collecting of these fungi in young North America. Many of the species were new to science. And as he collected these, he distributed them to different major universities around the country. And the University of Wisconsin in Madison was a young, growing powerhouse of research in the Midwest at the turn of the early 20th century. And so undoubtedly they came here in that way.
When I think of an archive of text material, I think, oh, there's books and maybe diaries and documents and things like that. What does a microfungus archive look like? What form
does it
take?
Well, it's certainly not very glamorous. if I were to show you these specimens, you'd probably give me a strange look. People who collect them are actually collecting little black spots or white powdery residues on the surfaces of plant leaves. So remember that these are the diseases of the plant. So we, in the specimen, not only get the fungus, but we get the host plant. And these are dried and they're packaged in envelopes with a label on the outside. So the specimen itself may not look all that attractive, but the history that is held within these is truly phenomenal.
Yeah, what stood out to you as you took a gander at the collection?
Well, so again, just the first thing was that we didn't even know that we had them. We're not the only museum that has these specimens. They're found around the country. But as we dug further, we came to see that it tells us a little bit about our history and our origin, that a prominent collector down in Alabama thought to send specimens here in the early days of our founding. And we were at one time a major research center in microfungi. I'm in the botany department, which is in the College of Letters and Science. One of our sister departments in the College of Agriculture is plant pathology, and they have kept this tradition alive of studying these parasitic fungi, even though we in the herbarium may not do that any longer.
Talking to Ken Cameron with the Wisconsin State Herbarium, talk about the recent discovery there of fungus samples collected by George Washington Carver. So you're digitizing this collection, a lot of stuff there. Are you expecting to find more surprises of one sort or another?
Yeah, I'm actually a little embarrassed to tell you how we found these specimens in the first place.
Oh, do tell us that.
Well, your listeners will find this amusing. We rely on a very large team of volunteers and students to help us manually database these records. And one of them had entered the word Alaska rather than Alabama for what was abbreviated ALA. And it was actually one of my colleagues in North Carolina who was combing the database online and said, hey, I think you've got something wrong in there. These Tuskegee is in Alabama, not in Alaska. And so I said, oh, thanks for letting me know. And she said, by the way, that's a specimen collected by George Washington Carver. And I said, wait a minute, you mean the African-American scientist? And so it all went from there.
Wow, that must have been an exciting day.
Yeah. So then, of course, we dug into the database and realized I think at this point we've found 28 or 30 of them, and we're going in alphabetical order. We're only up to the H's. So we expect that we're going to find several more.
So any chance you could have other treasures in your collection that you don't know about, or is this just kind of the once-in-a-lifetime fluke?
We always find treasures. I interviewed with you, I think, last year or 2 years ago, where we found a very special specimen that was collected on the battlefield during the Civil War. You may remember that story. So every day is an adventure. Every day is a new discovery. And we are happy that we can bring history back to life through these specimens.
So Wisconsin's home to this huge archive and now a digitized archive. How does that help our understanding, our research of the plants and, in this case, fungal world?
That's a great question. And the best way to answer it is that people who are looking at disease-causing organisms today, whether they be viruses like Zika or bacteria or fungi, are very interested in knowing the origin, the source, how the genetics of those pathogenic organisms have changed through time. And these fungi, even though they're over 100 years old, we can actually extract DNA from them and compare the genetics today to what existed in 1900 and see what changes have occurred in the genome. So We've already gotten calls from researchers across campus wanting access to these specimens.
So if I'm a researcher, I've discovered a new blight, and I want to say, where'd this come from? I can compare and contrast with what's on hand there, compare the DNA, see if there's an old strain, a new strain, that
exactly.
sort of thing.
Exactly. It's our closest thing to a time machine. We can't go back and actually collect these things living, but through the preserved form in the herbarium, we can offer up those research materials.
Is there a way for people to come visit? Is there anything for them to see if they do?
We are open to the public, but we're not a museum in the sense that we have exhibits for the public to see. But certainly anyone who would like to make an appointment, come in. I'd be happy to show them the specimens themselves.
Nice. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Ken Cameron, a professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium.
This presidential election season has seen a lot of buzz around anti-establishment candidates, some seeing short-term bursts of support, in some cases very much sustained success. People in exit polls point toward frustration with the American political system, dissatisfaction with Washington politics, and the need for a leader with a new vision to shake things up.
Well, our next guest says we need to be careful what we wish for. He says the past and present are full of bold new leaders, people with vision who led their country into tyranny.
Stephen M. Walt joins us now. He's the Robert and Renee Belford Professor of International Relations at Harvard University. His new piece at foreignpolicy.com is called "It's Time to Abandon the Pursuit for Great Leaders." Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Before we focus in on the U.S. And our election here, Stephen, you point in this piece toward a recent trend globally toward strong leaders with authoritarian leanings, places like Turkey, Egypt, Russia, the list goes on. Why do you think we're seeing this happen?
I'm not entirely sure why it's happening sort of worldwide, but I do think part of it has been the fact that the democracies, which we thought were sort of spreading wildly after the end of the Cold War and in the 1990s, have not performed particularly well. If you think of some of the problems the United States has had overseas, or the financial crisis in 2007-2008, the fact that the European Union, which is a democratic bastion, has suffered lots of strains, you can see why, at least in some parts of the world, there's been this tendency to want to opt for a single, great strongman or strong leader who promises that he'll solve all the problems that his people are facing. And there are some echoes of that I think we're seeing in the 2016 election.
Well, let's talk about it. And you point toward Donald Trump as one, and then the appeal of Donald Trump as one main example of this. How do you see that playing out?
Well, what's interesting about Trump is, right, his slogan, of course, he's going to make America great again, is very akin to what, other sort of authoritarian types have argued for their countries. But more importantly, he's yet to really explain how he's going to do any of these things, right? It's if you watch his speeches, if you watch even his debate performances, it's long on promises and rather short on specifics. It's essentially, I'm a winner, I'm great, I'm wonderful, and if you just let me take over, I'll fix all of these problems, everything's going to be terrific. And that's really not the way sort of democracy is supposed to work. The people are supposed to ask for a few more details about how these miracles are going to be accomplished.
The notion, I guess, would be that amid a political gridlock, a lot of problems faced by the country, would it be so bad to have somebody from the outside, somebody with a bold vision, come in and shake things up and hopefully get us out of our current doldrums?
Well, that's, of course, the appeal of strong leaders, and that's what they claim that they're going to do. We've heard that, of course, repeatedly in this country about, gridlock in Washington. All you have to do is pick me, and I'll find a way around it. But democracies depend on the idea of accountability and the idea of constraints on executive power. In fact, the entire history of this country is really based on the founding fathers' wisdom, I think, that nobody is infallible, and that you want to force even a powerful, imaginative, and visionary leader to win consensus, to bring others along with him or her, and you want to impose certain checks and balances on the unfettered exercise of executive power. I think that's based on the recognition that nobody's infallible, everybody makes mistakes, and if you have a single strong leader who thinks he or she knows what's right for the country and nobody else should be listened to, there's a real risk that they drive the country right off a cliff.
Now, you see in interviews with members, I think, of the public, in a place like Russia is one that comes to mind pretty often, where they sometimes might acknowledge, yes, the strong leader, whoever it is in that decade, there are problems, there might be human rights abuses, but it's an okay trade-off in exchange for security, lack of uncertainty for basic functioning. Is there a functional argument that that's not true? And even if it is true, is there a moral argument against it?
Well, certainly there's a moral argument in the sense that, you know, autocrats in a variety of countries have been the sources of the greatest human rights abuses. And the list there is long, whether one thinks, you know, Joseph Stalin or Mao Zedong or some other leaders who were able to, you know, get their followers to, you know, Adolf Hitler, get their followers to perform really horrendous acts and do that. So one of the concerns with a real dictator is that if they decide to order, you know, truly horrific acts, they may be able to carry those out. But even in the case of someone like Putin, I mean, you could make the argument that he has played a weak Russian hand reasonably effectively in a couple of places. But the long-term prospects for Russia are not particularly bright. It's a declining power in almost every way, and he's done nothing at home to reverse that particular trajectory. So even there, even in the case of Russia, trusting in a single leader and his vision doesn't seem to be yielding a brighter future for the society at large.
Couldn't we make the case that we've seen leaders like Abraham Lincoln, FDR, maybe Ronald Reagan? In many cases, they were strong leaders. They brought forward a profound vision, but while they might each have their failings and downsides, they didn't usher in an era of authoritarian government.
I think in almost all of those cases, these were leaders who, first of all, were democratically elected, who had to face the voters after 4 years, and even though they faced various challenges, were constantly forced to deal with the so-called loyal opposition in the other party, sometimes with great difficulty. These were not people who represented themselves as, you know, a sort of single visionary who had all the answers, and all you had to do was shut up and follow their orders, basically. So I think one of the great virtues in the United States is that we've managed to avoid having anyone who's been able to sort of escape the constraints that were built into the Constitution and yield unfettered executive power. And whenever we've gone in that direction, which has happened once or twice when we faced real national emergencies, the pendulum has swung back very quickly towards a more balanced balanced situation between executive power and the constraints of the legislative branch and the judicial branch. And what worries me is I see these trends around the world and then see what's happening, at least rhetorically, in this election, is worrying if we're maybe skating a little too close to people being willing to turn things over to a single leader.
Talking to Stephen Walt from Harvard University, in a recent piece, he worries about our desire for a strong leadership and worries that that can lead to authoritarian government. Stephen, would our system allow an authoritarian president? University of Chicago law professor Eric Posner wrote a piece lately making the case that, for the most part, our institutions would limit the ability, even if, and he's focusing on Donald Trump here, he's saying even if Donald Trump got elected and even if he really did have this desire to rule as an authoritarian leader, he couldn't. His hands would be tied.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that. I think, American institutions were set up over 200 years ago precisely to avoid this problem, precisely to avoid the problem of tyranny. And I think they've worked remarkably well. You do worry, I think, a little bit about the mechanisms by which democracies do fail. And we do have cases in history of democracies that have lost that institutional strength over time, usually when populations were scared, usually when the institutions themselves didn't seem to be performing particularly well and people became disenchanted with them. And I think we have at least hints of that today in both the Republican Party with Trump and in a different way in the Democratic Party with the support that Sanders has gotten in this election, I think surprising many people. My own view is we're a long way from heading down that particular path, but you do, I think, want to be mindful of the danger, particularly when you see a politician, you know, with no real experience and with some pretty remarkable rhetoric doing as well as Trump has done on the campaign trail.
Speaking of rhetoric, I wonder if we've maybe defined tyranny down in this country a little bit. Critics of President Obama calling him a tyrant, critics of George W. Bush from the other side calling him a fascist or a tyrant, things like that. Have we lost sight of what that would actually look like if it were for real?
That's a very good point, and obviously I think the rhetoric does get overheated when sort of partisanship weighs in. But you do worry about some of the things we saw over the past decade or so. You know, we have seen greater government secrecy. We have seen governments, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, going after whistleblowers. We do see the United States, indulging in torture under the Bush administration, something that you would think would be completely anathema to the United States, and the Obama administration relying very heavily on special operations forces, covert action, drone warfare, things like that. And all of that happening at a moment also when sort of political participation is down in the United States, fewer people voting in elections, et cetera. And this is sort of not a sudden, swift descent into authoritarianism, but what I worry about is rather the slow erosion of a set of democratic traditions, the consolidation of greater executive power over time, and gradually you see the sort of traditional civil liberties and democratic freedoms we've long enjoyed getting eaten away.
Talking to Professor Stephen Walt about leadership and politics, he says we need to be careful what we wish for. The desire for a strong, dynamic leader in uncertain times can lead to authoritarian government down the road.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions for our guest. Looking at today's political landscape with divided government, gridlock in Congress, increased polarization, do you think we need a strong, dynamic leader to get things working? Or do you worry that this could lead to authoritarian government here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Stephen Walt, international relations professor at Harvard University. In a recent piece for Foreign Policy magazine, he writes that it's time to stop hoping for great leaders to guide us through troubled times.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's the appeal of a strong, dynamic leader? Do you think the United States might be at a point where we could elect a leader who would lead us to an authoritarian government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers with Jamie in Johnson Creek. Jamie, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I wanted to ask a question about how he felt about Citizens United. I really feel that the money in politics that our government has basically bought and paid for.
Jamie, thanks for the call. And there's a couple ways to tackle it, I think, Stephen. One, that what she's saying directly is that Citizens United is leading toward a more oligarchic form of government, mainly, maybe, but also it could be leading to disillusionment. That's what's appealing about an outsider candidate.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing in 2016 is an election where there's at least a substantial percentage of the American population, maybe not a majority, but a substantial percentage, that are now convinced that the political system is basically rigged, that it's an oligarchy bought by wealthy people featuring largely corrupt politicians who are in it for themselves, not really interested in the country as a whole, and that are not distributing the various goods of the American economy to everybody else. That's clearly been the appeal of Bernie Sanders' campaign, and to some degree also Trump has been trying to sound out that theme of sort of the angry middle class or lower middle class voter as well. And part of his appeal, of course, then is the claim that, you know, he's already rich, he won't be for sale, he'll finance his own campaign, won't be beholden to others. What you're really seeing here is a sort of lack of regard or a disenchantment with the entire institutional structure of American democracy. And I don't think that automatically leads to authoritarianism, but it does make people more willing to say, look, we don't have to rely upon these institutions that we've used for the last couple of hundred few years. What we really need is somebody from completely outside the political system to fix these problems for us. And if that person doesn't fix them immediately, then they ask for more power, and maybe there's a demand for greater executive authority. That's the kind of road that could ultimately lead to something very different than what we've known in this country for the last two centuries.
Maybe part of the problem is we pay too much attention to the Cadillac election, the president, and maybe not enough to everything from our city council to the U.S. Senate and in between. Do we need to focus more on paying attention to those elections and maybe fixing the problems of leadership there instead of hoping for somebody to change it all from the top?
Well, I think that's a good point. What makes ultimately democracies thrive is not just the national elections or who's in the White House, but actually how well public institutions are working at all levels. That means getting effective people in Congress, getting people who are serving honorably at local school districts and in municipalities. And I think, again, there has been this widespread sense for a variety of reasons that these institutions are not functioning as well as they used to. And those are the settings which, in I think certain circumstances, increase the appeal of sort of the man or woman on the white horse walking in or riding in to save us from a dysfunctional political order.
Let's go back to our callers now. Joe is on the line in Burlington. Joe, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Joe?
Not so much a question as I'd just like to hear Stephen's take on the way I'm seeing similarities between what Donald Trump is talking about, where he's saying, we would bar a certain type of religion from entering our country. We would gather up 11 million people of a certain ethnicity and eject them from the country. And obviously that can't be done without concentration camps. There's no way to get those people out of here without gathering them in camps and interning them somehow before transport. Some of the other things that he's talking about, I'm seeing some very stark similarities to the late 30s in Germany.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Do you worry with this sort of ethnic and religion-based rhetoric, Stephen?
Yeah, I do, in part because I think if you look at where democracies have eroded in the past, where you've seen movements toward more authoritarian types of politics, it's often linked to a fear of internal enemies and a fear of internal disorder. In other words, if we have problems here, it's not because there are just challenges that we have to pull together and meet, but it's because there are some folks inside the country that aren't really loyal, that we can't really trust, and we need to find ways to control them, either to get them out of here or maybe put them under surveillance, keep watch on them. And because people like security and they like order, in some circumstances, there'll be some part of the population that's very susceptible to that. It's a danger, obviously, whenever the country is at war, to look around and see if there are those who might not be loyal, etc. And to some degree in this campaign, you've seen, as the caller indicated, Trump say things that are indicative of sort of playing to this nativist, xenophobic tendency. I don't think, again, that's going to lead automatically to a 1930s-style dictatorship. I think the United States is light years away from that. But it's the kind of trend you don't want to see in this country. And certainly it's the kind of rhetoric that, again, will cause some people to think that maybe, a stronger government that keeps order and keeps watch on those people is a good thing. And again, that's, I think, a fundamentally anti-American way to go.
Talking to Stephen Walt from Harvard University about political leadership, a presidential election year, the desire for a strong leader in uncertain times, and where it can take us. And Stephen, I've used the phrase "in uncertain times" lately, and you see this in a lot of reporting. People are worried, fearful about what's going on in the country, around in the world. But I wonder, are we really in particularly bad times right now? We've been through a depression, World War II, Cold War, through a lot of years there, and not lapsing into an authoritarian form of government. Are these particularly troubling times, really?
I actually think the dangers have been greatly exaggerated, but they're not zero. Mm-hmm. Certainly the danger that the United States faces from either internal enemies or even external foes is actually quite low right now. Despite all the attention that's been paid to terrorism and things like that, these are problems, but they are not existential threats. They are far less than many other dangers that we accept routinely and the external dangers that we have faced at other points in our history. So in that sense, this concern is, I think, greatly exaggerated. Where it is legitimate, I think, is more on the economic front. Although the American economy has been doing better than most other industrial powers, it's clear that that growth is not being shared widely within our society, and there are segments within America that are not doing well at all. You know, hedge fund billionaires may be doing terrifically well, and people who are very well educated and have good jobs, but the sort of solid middle and working class have not benefited, and they are at least a part of the core that has rallied to both Trump on the Republican side and Sanders on the Democratic side for something different, you know, a change in the economic order, something that feels fairer to them. So in that sense, I think there is a basis for some of that anger.
I know we're not psychologists here, but do you think that the economic uncertainty is magnifying all of these other threats?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it just plays into a general sense that, you know, things are uncertain today. We don't know where we're headed, and it very much plays into the idea that of a sort of nostalgia for the past, that there was this golden era, and, you know, pick your decade, but where the United States really was great, and people really did have jobs, and communities really were safe, and everything was really just fine. When someone like Trump talks about making America great again, that's what he's trying to hearken to, this sort of mythical image of a moment when everything really was wonderful. It was probably never as good as he's trying to paint it, and he hasn't told us how he would even restore that or move us to something better in the future. But there's no question that that's the kind of emotion that he's trying to appeal to.
Given, in our last minute or so, given the economic problems you mentioned, the political dysfunction we've talked about, do you see a hope for better solutions, apart from reaching to a strong visionary leader to just fix them for us?
Well, again, the key here is that the solution is usually not to place one's faith in a single leader and just, you know, follow them blindly. That's fundamentally not how democracy works. Having a creative, intelligent, politically savvy leadership is a good thing, and having a president who's thoughtful and creative and knows how to play the political game effectively would be, of course, in everybody's interest. I mean, there are better presidents than others, and the country does better when we have good leadership. But ultimately, the strength of the country is not the brilliance or creativity of a single person in the White House. It's the functioning of the whole set of political institutions and their interaction with the other sectors of our society. And trying to put all of our faith in a single person is often a recipe for disaster, particularly if that person isn't constrained or held accountable by strong democratic institutions.
We'll leave it there for now. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure talking with you.
That's Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard University.